Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man I've been privileged to know and work with over many years in various facets of that war is the former Undersecretary of Defense for Policy at the George W. Bush Pentagon. Douglas J. Fife is his name. He has distinguished himself both in that role and in many others before and since, including today, as a senior fellow at the Hudson Institute, as a man of great perspicacity, thoughtfulness, clarity of vision, and an ability to articulate that is almost unparalleled, certainly in official Washington these days. I'm privileged to call him a friend, and better yet, to have him as a guest for a full hour of a very, very important, very timely, very special conversation about what I call the Obama bomb deal. Doug Fife, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. Great to have you with us.
Great to be with you.
Well, you have observed, Doug, in various quarters, that the argument that we're hearing, that this deal has problems, tends to draw us into a discussion of the details. And we will spend, in the course of this hour, a fair amount of time talking about the details. But like Charles Krauthammer, I believe you've concluded that the devil is actually in the structure of the thing, for starters. Give us a sense of that assessment.
I think that the essence of this Iran deal is a problem because Iran will get relief from the economic sanctions, which means in the first year alone, around $150 billion worth of cash. And it gets this in return for some promises relating to its nuclear weapons program. And the U.S. in general has problems with Iran that span a wide area. I mean, their nuclear weapons program is clearly one major problem in our relationship with Iran, but it's not the only one. The Iranians are extremely hostile to the West. They are a revolutionary ideological government trying to spread their Islamist revolution around the world. They are major supporters of terrorism. They support Hezbollah. They support Palestinian Islamic Jihad and Hamas and other groups. They've been active from Argentina to Europe, throughout the Middle East and elsewhere. And they are a major threat to American friends and partners in the region, in the Persian Gulf area, Saudi Arabia, and the other Arabian Peninsula countries, and Israel. And so giving them $150 billion right away and more money down the road through the relief of sanctions, simply in return for their making some promises relating to their nuclear program, it means that they're going to be enormously strengthened in all these other problem areas. And then furthermore, the promises they're making in the nuclear area are not anywhere near as impressive as President Obama and Secretary Kerry have suggested. So that's fundamentally the problem with this deal. And I don't think you need to get into the details of the 100-plus page agreement to see that flaw in the agreement.
We will get into those details. Having said that, I just to stay at the 30,000-foot level, Doug Fife, the argument that the administration is basically making is that the possibility that this deal will work out and actually keep Iran from having nuclear weapons for a period of time, and there's a heated dispute as to how long that will be, but they're arguing it will be at least for 10 years, and throughout that period, there'll be a year from a breakout and so on. And the alternative to that very, well, basic and perhaps even inadequate arrangement is that they will avoid a war, that we will not have that as the only real alternative. Talk a little bit about your response to that contention and why the critics of this agreement are entitled actually to find in recent experience, including that you had during your time in the Pentagon as the Undersecretary of Defense for Policy, an alternative in the form of what I think you've called in the Wall Street Journal coercive diplomacy.
Yes, the president has said that the alternative to his diplomatic approach to Iran, the approach that produced this deal, was war. And so he's been able to deflect a lot of criticism of the deal by saying, you know, that the criticism may or may not be true, but the alternative is clearly worse than anything he's done, because the alternative is war. And I don't think that's a correct way of seeing the situation, and I don't think he's correct in saying that the only alternative to his diplomacy was war. There are two major ways of approaching diplomacy with problem countries. One way, which I would call cooperative diplomacy, is based on the idea that we can make a deal with a basically well-intentioned other country based on a common agreement on the rules of the road. And that if you're dealing with a country that's trustworthy, if you're dealing with a country that where you have some differences, but you're basically, you share principles, then you can resolve a problem in a cooperative way and expect them to comply with their arrangement, and the whole operation is cooperative. I don't think it's realistic to do that with a country like Iran that is as hostile and uncooperative as they are. But there's the alternative to that kind of cooperative diplomacy, which is the approach that the Obama administration, in fact, took toward the Iranians, and I think is naive. The alternative is not war. The alternative is what I would call coercive diplomacy, where you use diplomacy to clarify, not to seek cooperation with a hostile and uncooperative regime, but to clarify lines, where you say to a regime that you don't trust, we want to make sure that there are no misunderstandings here. If you do certain things, then we will do certain things in response. But if you do hostile things, then we will increase the pressure on you as follows. So you use diplomacy to try to shape the other country's behavior by being clear about what kinds of penalties they will face if they do dangerous and hostile and uncooperative things, or what kind of relief you can give them if they start doing things that you think are more beneficial and improve the security of the world. And that kind of diplomacy, which has nothing to do with assuming the good intentions of the other side, was an option. And we would have been much better off, if we're going to conduct diplomacy with Iran, conducting a coercive type diplomacy than this completely naive approach that President Obama and Secretary Kerry used with the Iranians.
Yeah, naive is a charitable way to describe it, feckless and as I indicated, wholly inadequate, perhaps is a little bit more to the point. Doug Feith, we have to take a short break. When we come back, we'll talk a bit about that practice of coercive diplomacy during the Bush administration and its success in ending the nuclear weapons program of Libya, and more generally, the negotiation practice of this administration, by contrast. Doug Feith, the author of War and Decision: Inside the Pentagon at the Dawn of the War on Terrorism, and many other fine, fine publications, right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
Over the past decade, while the American military and intelligence community have been engaged in a kinetic war overseas against a wide array of enemies aligned with the global jihadist movement, the Center for Security Policy has consistently shed light upon a dark and subversive effort that thrives nearly unopposed right here in this country, the one known by the Muslim Brotherhood as Civilization Jihad. In an effort to educate freedom-loving Americans about Civilization Jihad and how it has been waged against every facet of American civilization, the Center for Security Policy has, in 2015, begun publishing a series of monographs called the Civilization Jihad Reader Series. The first of these monographs is entitled Sharia in American Courts, and it documents how Sharia, divine Islamic law, which animates the global jihadist movement, has entered our very own court system. In this study, the Center documents how parties to litigation in American appellate courts have attempted to use Sharia to resolve 146 cases in 32 different states, potentially threatening the constitutional rights of our citizens, particularly women and children. The monograph not only highlights these cases, but the organizations here in America that are actively and successfully working to insinuate Sharia into our judiciary. Finally, it provides information on at least one antidote to this infirmity, a law that has been adopted in 8 states, one that protects our citizens against the use of foreign law and upholds our Constitution as the supreme law of the land, lest those who fight to defend our Constitution overseas do not come home to see it subordinated in a courtroom in their own home state. Learn more by reading Sharia in American Courts, which can be found on Amazon.com or the Center for Security Policy's website at www.securefreedom.org.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the War of Ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
I'm Jared Ogden, former Navy SEAL and member of Team Military on National Geographic Channel's Ultimate Survival Alaska. I want to tell you about an issue that you probably haven't heard much about. Thousands of America's veterans are suffering from occupational and environmental exposures that they were exposed to while serving in the military. We call these the toxic wounds of war. From Agent Orange and Gulf War illness to post-9/11 burn pit exposure and heavy metals in the air, and other toxic exposures that we don't fully understand. The Sergeant Sullivan Center is a powerful voice in our nation's capital, standing watch over these forgotten wounded. These men and women can't do it alone, and they need your help today. Every dollar raised by Sergeant Sullivan Center goes to medical research, public awareness, and advocacy. You can make a tax-deductible donation today at www.sergeantsullivancenter.org. That's SGTSullivanCenter.org.
This is Frank Effney. You're listening to AM 1260, The Answer.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back visiting with Douglas Feith, the former Undersecretary of Defense for Policy, the number 3 position in the Defense Department during the George W. Bush administration. At an epic moment, by the way, chronicled in his masterful memoirs entitled War and Decision, Inside the Pentagon at the Dawn of the War on Terrorism. Doug, we were talking a bit about there being really an alternative approach to dealing with a hostile power like the Iranians, in the fashion that the Obama administration has done what you call a collaborative diplomacy or cooperative diplomacy. In the case of disarming Libya of its nuclear weapons program, your team was highly successful in applying this other approach, the coercive diplomacy, as you call it. Just remind us of both the difference in approach and the difference in outcome.
Well, the George W. Bush administration made it clear that we were focused on the particular dangers that came from regimes that both supported terrorism and pursued weapons of mass destruction. Because after 9/11, which created a new era in international affairs, there was an appreciation of how dangerous weapons of mass destruction in the hands of terrorist groups would be. And so the President Bush focused the world's attention with his axis of evil speech on the idea that that there are countries that both pursue WMD and support terrorism and could become sources of WMD for terrorist groups. So that was a major theme. And having made that point, President Bush then decided to overthrow the government of Afghanistan and then to overthrow the government of Iraq. And immediately after the overthrow of Saddam Hussein, or soon thereafter, the United States intercepted a shipment of nuclear weapons-related material that was going to Libya. And we intercepted it on a ship in the Mediterranean, and it highlighted the Libyan nuclear weapons program. And when that interception occurred, the Libyan dictator Muammar Gaddafi panicked and realized that he may suffer the fate of the leaders of Afghanistan and Iraq. And in his panic, he decided that he was going to change Libya's policy on WMD and give up his program. And so he invited the British and the Americans in and told us what he had in the way of WMD production capability and facilities and materiel, and told us much more than we knew. I mean, this wasn't like dealing with the Iranians now, where we have to pull teeth to get information and they give us dishonest information and they drag us out. I mean, Gaddafi had obviously come to the decision. I mean, he felt coerced by circumstances. He came to the decision that he wanted out of that business. And so he completely openly revealed information, invited American and British experts in, and told us a lot more than we knew. I mean, it wasn't, as I said, a matter of grilling him and trying to extract pieces of information. He just opened up the books, as it were. And we dismantled his chemical and nuclear programs. And that was a really high watermark in international nonproliferation efforts. And it's an example of how a regime of that kind can be coerced by its concern of what the consequences are, by the consequences of its pursuing weapons of mass destruction programs that we consider to be unacceptable and extremely dangerous.
Let me just ask Doug Feith, because you not only served, as I've mentioned, in the George W. Bush administration at the highest levels of government. Back in the day when we were young men in the Reagan administration, you were responsible for negotiations policy as a Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense. And in the course of what we've been watching here, and specifically the contrast between coercive diplomacy as successfully practiced in Libya by the Bush administration we've witnessed a totally different approach. Again, you've suggested it was naive. It really seems as though it was hapless and almost pathetic, certainly humiliating, the way John Kerry and the Obama team, and for that matter, it must be said, the other members of this negotiation, to the extent that they played a role in shaping its final outcome, was absolutely at odds with this approach. It was pleading, not coercive. It was capitulating, not demanding. Give us a flavor, as you see it, with a broad brush of history as the background here, how this negotiation's practice, tradecraft, performed and gave rise to this particular result.
I don't think that the problem that President Obama and Secretary Kerry had with the Iranians resulted from their inability to negotiate in a tough fashion. I don't think that's the problem. The problem, and the fact that they can be tough, is proven by how tough they are in negotiating with their domestic political opponents.
Yeah, the toughness seems reserved for that, though, I must say.
Yeah, no, but I really think it's important to understand that it's not a lack of negotiating skill that we saw in their approach to Iran. I think there was a strategic idea they had, a really bad strategic idea, in my opinion. But the negotiations looked like they were being poorly negotiated because they were actually being motivated by a completely misguided strategic idea. And the strategic idea that was motivating these talks was that if the United States changed its behavior and became friendlier, more modest, more cooperative with the Iranians, more apologetic toward the Iranians, that we could repair the damage in our relationship with Iran that President Obama believes the United States was responsible for over the decades, and that we could turn Iran from a hostile country into a cooperative and, in time, friendly country, and that we could move from confrontation to cooperation and joint projects with Iran. And I think that's the reason that we made concession after concession. It's not that President Obama is incapable of being hard-headed and tough. And if you look at the way he's dealt with the Republicans on Capitol Hill, he's been one of the most hard-headed and one of the toughest and one of the most kind of ruthless negotiators that we've ever had as president.
No, it's true. And it's a very fair point. And I want to develop a little further after the break. This is really the crux of the issue, is what has come about as a result of this misguided policy approach towards the Iranians. When we come back, the former Undersecretary of Defense for Policy, Douglas J. Feith, will talk with us about some of the particulars of this deal that make it not only defective in myriad ways, but downright dangerous for folks like us. That and more, straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Senator Marco Rubio called it Obama's Capitulation Monday. That aptly describes what happened yesterday with the president's diabolical twofer, the UN Security Council's endorsement of the Obama bomb deal with Iran and the opening of embassies formalizing normalization of relations between the U.S. and Cuba. Florida's junior senator warned that, quote, we have entered the most dangerous phase of the Obama presidency, in which the president is flat out abandoning America's vital national security interests to cozy up to the world's most reprehensible regimes, unquote. Having failed to stop President Obama's fundamental transformation of America before now, Republicans and the rest of our countrymen risk even worse and more reckless behavior from him and his administration. Congressional rejection of the Iran deal is the place to halt and begin to reverse this perilous agenda. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
This is Frank Affney, host of Secure Freedom Radio. I wanted to encourage you to attend, if possible, and certainly to monitor a very important development on July 22nd. It will be the Stop Iran Now rally in Times Square, a rally for peace through strength, with a number of the most important individuals in our country working to defeat the Obama bomb deal. For more information about this important event, go to info@stopiranrally.org. Thanks.
Secure Freedom announces the launch of our newest initiative, the Counter Jihad Campaign at counterjihad.com. We have gathered some of the foremost experts and activists to begin our fight back against those who long ago declared war on us. You can see our first two ads asking those who see something bad happening, like the attack in Garland, Texas, or the dozen jihadists at the Boston Marathon Killers Mosque, to say something. Join us and be a part of the Counter Jihad.
When we decided to rename this radio station, we came up with one word, one very big word, answer. It's because we know our listeners better than anybody. We know you wake up every day with an insatiable appetite for news and information. But more than that, you want to know what to make of it all. That's why we're here. Do this better than any station in town. Welcome aboard. AM 1260, The Answer.
This is Fred Fleitz with the Center for Security Policy. Now that the June 30th deadline for a nuclear agreement with Iran has passed, Secretary of State John Kerry is in Vienna struggling to finalize an agreement. Listeners to this program know that the nuclear talks are deeply flawed and a bad deal is preordained. We now know one reason for this bad deal is because the Rockefeller Foundation spent millions to back a loose coalition of peace groups, think tanks, and former U.S. officials to push for a nuclear agreement with Iran. This included freelance diplomacy with Iranian officials over the past 10 years. In addition, a core member of this effort is former CIA official Paul Pillar, who wrote a 2012 article titled, "We Can Live with a Nuclear Iran." This explains why a bad deal with Iran will emerge from the nuclear talks. This is another reason why Congress must kill this deal. I'm Fred Fleitz. Learn more at our new website on the Iran talks, irantruth.org.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. We are engaged in a very thoughtful, extended, and important conversation with Douglas J. Feith, formerly the Undersecretary of Defense for Policy, among other things. He worked in other capacities in the Defense Department, the National Security Council. He is currently a senior fellow with the Hudson Institute, a highly regarded institution in Washington, D.C., and the director of its Center for National Security Strategies. You can find his writings both at the Hudson.org website and frequently on the pages of outstanding publications like The Wall Street Journal, The New York Times, Washington Post, and so on. He is the author of the single best book on the war on terror. I call it The War for the Free World, but it is the subtitle of his book entitled War and Decision. Inside the Pentagon at the dawn of the war on terrorism. He was not only inside the Pentagon, he was one of its preeminent figures in strategizing and executing the plan for dealing with the war that was thrust upon us with 9/11. Doug Feith, again, thank you so much for your time today. You've laid the groundwork brilliantly in terms of how we got here. Let's talk about where we are now and where we're likely to be as a result of this deal. And there are five things that I'd like to particularly ask you to address about it, quite apart from the issues that are generally discussed, notably that the infrastructure remains in place and verification is mostly, as you've taught me, a matter of looking under the lamplight, like the drunk who dropped his keys someplace else, but the light's better there. Missing, therefore, the real possibilities, in fact, likelihood, that there will be a lot of stuff going on in Iran that we won't be privy to. But let me ask you about five specific things. The first is that we now find ourselves, as a result of this agreement, committed to help actually advance Iran's nuclear program, including by bringing to bear advanced nuclear reactor technology and the like, and assistance from the so-called international community. What are the implications of that?
Well, one of the flaws in the approach to nonproliferation for many years has been the idea that when countries promise not to develop nuclear weapons, that various other countries around the world will commit to helping them develop peaceful nuclear technologies. And unfortunately, this has been used by cynical governments to extract important nuclear technology that bad governments then use for improper military purposes. And that basic idea continues in this agreement. And so there are provisions in here for countries to feel obliged to help the Iranians develop nuclear technology that the Iranians promise they will not use for improper purposes. But we know from their history, they violated promises of that kind.
Notably, the North Koreans come to mind, and I was struck by the news this morning that the North Koreans have said they're not interested in a deal like the Iranians have, having had a deal like that already, as you know, under the Clinton administration, Doug, which has left them with actually a nuclear weapons program, full stop. Doug, there are two other facets of this deal that don't have anything to do with the nuclear program per se, that we were told were therefore outside of the ambit of these negotiations. And yet it seems as though very, very ominous concessions were made, namely with respect to the embargoes on Iran's access to conventional arms imports and also ballistic missile technologies and activities. What are, again, the implications of those concessions?
I think those really are among the most outrageous aspects of a shockingly bad deal. And the argument that they are outrageous is supported by what the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, President Obama's own chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, said just a few days before the deal was concluded, when he was asked in front of a congressional panel about the possibility that the United States might lift the restrictions on sales of conventional weapons and missiles to Iran. And he said, as he described maintaining those restrictions as a red line for him, you know, implying that he couldn't support the agreement if those restrictions were removed. But the deal did, in fact, remove those restrictions. And you in your question, highlighted the fact that these are not tied closely to the nuclear program. I mean, in other words, what the administration did was it justified not raising a long list of problems that we have with Iran that are really crucial to our whole strategic difficulty with the Iranian regime. It justified not raising those issues on the grounds that it was going to be focused narrowly on the nuclear issue. Then at the last minute, the Iranians and the Russians demanded that things that would be beneficial to Iran that were not tied closely to the nuclear program, like the conventional weapons restrictions and the missile restrictions, should be brought into the deal. And the Obama administration said yes. So when it came to things that would be beneficial to us that were not directly related to the nuclear deal, the administration left those things out, but at the last minute was willing to grant bringing in some concessions that were beneficial to Iran. It's really that really is a really one of the most troubling aspects of this very troubling deal.
And both of us have sort of suggested that these things like ballistic missiles don't have anything to do with the nuclear program, except, of course, they are the delivery system of choice for a nuclear weapons program. And I think it's fair to say that in the absence of a nuclear weapon, having an intercontinental range ballistic missile doesn't make much sense. And we're clearly going to see that capability coming along under the Iranian efforts and perhaps aided and abetted by an international community that will perhaps quite soon be capable of giving them a hand, all intensifying the threat to this country, of course.
And their ability to advance their missile program, missiles that could eventually reach us, is enormously increased by the large sums of money they're going to get through the lifting of the sanctions.
And that's really what I wanted to hit again. We've discussed, Doug, elsewhere, the chairman of the Oversight Committee of the House Ways and Means Committee, Congressman Pete Roskam, says the equivalent amount in the U.S. economy, which is, of course, much larger than Iran's, of a $150 billion windfall would be $8 trillion. That suggests a massive increase in the ability of the Iranians, as you've said it earlier, to engage in all manner of activities, including those that threaten us. Another very troubling facet of this. Let me ask you finally, Doug, one of the things that I guess came about at the very, very end of the end game, another astonishing concession, has to do with not only advancing, as we've discussed, the Iranian nuclear program, but actually committing to protect it. What is up with that?
Well, this entire deal takes a program that had made Iran for many years a pariah state in the world and the subject of United Nations resolutions that required countries, actually obligated all UN members to cut their economic ties to Iran. It turns that program that had made Iran into a pariah into a completely legitimate program that is entitled to the kind of protection that every country has for its legitimate activities.
With the help of the international community in this case. That's the thing that just boggles my mind, is that we're finding ourselves taking on responsibilities to take that same pariah state qualifying program and make it now something that we're investing in protecting. Doug, we have to pause for just a moment. When we come back, I want to talk about, having set the stage as you have masterfully, what this is likely to mean in terms of actually increasing the prospects of war in the Middle East and perhaps beyond. Douglas J. Feith, our guest, back with that and more straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
It's been over 7 years since a church group from another state brought a couple hundred refugees to the rural county where I live. I wanted to know, how could they do this? What was the governmental process that allowed the resettlement of refugees to a county ill-prepared to assimilate them? Employment opportunities were scarce. The health department was not familiar with illnesses and mental health problems of people who came from parts of the third world. The school system was not prepared to teach large numbers of students who didn't speak English.
That's author Ann Corcoran discussing her new book, Federal Immigration Policy, Resettlement and the Hijra to America. She explains how Muslim immigrants are being quietly resettled into American towns without vetting them, even for terrorist links. Corcoran also explains how the global jihad movement is using immigration as a stealth campaign to spread its influence in America. You can read Federal Immigration Policy, Resettlement, and the Hijra to America on securefreedom.org or purchase a copy on amazon.com.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the War of Ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
I'm Robert Muse, co-founder and senior counsel of the American Freedom Law Center, our nation's premier public interest law firm fighting for your faith and freedom in courtrooms across America. Make no mistake, we live in a pivotal time. Secular progressives such as Barack Obama and his surrogates are zealously sweeping religion from the public square, foisting Sharia law and other harmful international precedents into our courts and constitution, assaulting the traditional family, and weakening our national defense by, among other things, undermining the strength of our military through social engineering and political correctness. But I can assure you that the American Freedom Law Center is aggressively engaging our nation's enemies with offensive lawfare to defend our fundamental rights and to fight stealth jihad in all of its forms, including the civilization jihad being waged by Muslim Brotherhood front groups operating here in the U.S. Indeed, there is no other public interest law firm as uniquely qualified to fight this battle. But we need your prayers and financial support to succeed. Please consider a tax-deductible donation to support our critical fight for your faith and freedom. Visit us at www.AmericanFreedomLawCenter.org.
I'm Fred Fleitz with the Center for Security Policy. One of President Obama's worst foreign policy failings is the lack of a strategy to defeat Al-Qaeda and ISIS. These terrorist groups are part of a global movement to establish Islamic supremacy and Sharia through violence. This movement is called the Global Jihad Movement. It will not be defeated without a strategy that recognizes its true nature. In January 2015, we issued a comprehensive strategy to defeat the global jihad movement. It is called the Secure Freedom Strategy and is based on National Security Directive 75, the strategy that President Ronald Reagan used to defeat the global totalitarian threat of his time, the Soviet Union. Like President Reagan's strategy, we lay out a comprehensive plan on how the United States government can be reorganized and focused to understand and defeat the global jihad movement. You can read the Secure Freedom Strategy at securefreedom.org, or you can purchase a copy on Amazon.com. I'm Fred Fleitz.
This is Jenny Thomas. I do video interviews of leaders with the Daily Caller. I had the privilege recently of interviewing Diana West about her extraordinary new book, American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. You can see it at dailycaller.com. American Betrayal reads like a spellbinding historical thriller, but it is also a carefully documented account of how the U.S. government was penetrated by communist agents in the years after President Roosevelt normalized relations with the Soviet Union. Diana West shows how a similar assault is being mounted today by yet another collectivist ideology, the supremacist Islamic doctrine of Sharia. She establishes that while the communists and the Islamists may have very different visions of the world, they have employed the same techniques to defeat America. Please watch my conversation with Diana West about American Betrayal, then check out the other great leaders we profile at dailycaller.com.
Annie Soldier Incorporated was started in August 2003 as a simple family effort to help the soldiers in one Army unit, thus the name. However, due to overwhelming requests, on January 1, 2004, the Annie Soldier effort was expanded so it would include any member of any of the armed services in harm's way. Won't you please help? Find out how by going to www.anysoldier.com today.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back, joined for our final installment of this very important conversation over the hour with Douglas J. Feith, a friend and colleague of many years, notably the Undersecretary of Defense for Policy during the George W. Bush administration. You really will not understand much of what we're talking about without addressing it through the prism of his superb memoirs, War and Decision: Inside the Pentagon at the Dawn of the War on Terrorism. Doug, again, thank you for your time. Let's turn to, you know, crystal ball gazing, if we can. What do you think the prospects are, since much is now being made, as we discussed earlier, of this deal as an alternative to war, that we may actually wind up with war as a result of this deal? A war that, by the way, I believe has been underway since 1979 on the part of the Iranians against this country and others. But the possibility of it turning into something vastly worse for the reasons we've just been discussing.
Well, one of the famous traits of many governments all over the world throughout history is that they accomplish the opposite of their intended result. And I think that this deal on the Iranian nuclear program is going to have the effect of increasing the drive of many other countries in the region and around the world to get nuclear weapons of their own. I think one of the worst consequences of legitimating the Iranian program after years of efforts by the International Atomic Energy Agency and the UN Security Council and the European Union negotiators and then the group that negotiated this deal, one of the consequences of Iran's defying all of them and violating its nonproliferation obligations under the Nonproliferation Treaty and doing all of that and then emerging on the other side as a victor that gets rewarded and gets sanctions lifted and everything else without having to actually give up its nuclear weapons program, is that they proved that they can, the Iranians proved that they can defy and essentially destroy the nonproliferation architecture of the world without penalty. And that lesson is going to be seen and heeded by, in the first instance, all their neighbors in the Middle East. And I think it's likely that we will see an interest in nuclear weapons programs on the part of Saudi Arabia, Egypt, Turkey, and other countries. And I think that that will have effects not only in the Middle East, but around the world. And one of the most worrisome aspects of this entire horrible deal is not simply the bad things that Iran will do, but even if Iran completely complies with its obligations, one of the consequences of this deal is going to be to encourage other countries around the world to get their own nuclear weapons programs. And if we wind up down the road a few years, 10, 20, 30 years down the road, with a world in which 20 countries or 30 countries have their own nuclear weapons, the likelihood of nuclear war increases enormously. And the world becomes a much more dangerous place. And that's something that is extremely ironic, because this president came into office committed to what he called nuclear zero, or a world with zero nuclear weapons, which I think was an unrealistic goal in any event. But he's going to wind up achieving a world with 2, 3, 4 times the number of nuclear weapons countries as a result of this extremely ill-advised diplomacy that he's done with the Iranians.
Yeah. And Doug, you know, one of the things that I'm struck by, I think you're absolutely right, of course, is that countries that seek this kind of capability, especially under circumstances in which they feel an imminent threat from this rising hegemon, is that they don't have to go about it the way the Iranians have done, painstakingly and covertly building all of the necessary elements of the food chain, if you will, of a nuclear weapons program. They can simply buy them. And there seem to be people who are quite willing to sell them, and probably Pakistan, they have in the past with AQ Khan's network, but also presumably the cash-strapped North Korea. So we may see this upon us rather quickly. And as you say, it seems to me, not only the real prospect of nuclear war in a very difficult and dangerous part of the world, but possibly not one that can be contained to it. And that brings me to perhaps our last question or line of questioning, Doug, about the decision of the Obama administration to pursue UN approval of this deal through the Security Council on Monday before Congress was given an opportunity, even under the very truncated and, I think, anti-constitutional arrangements set out by the Corker-Cardin deal. Talk about the role of the UN, the role of the administration in sort of raising up its authority over our own sovereign decision-making process, such as it is.
Well, the president has closed off the options that Congress had by going to the UN, getting the sanctions removed before he's even heard from Congress as to whether it approves this deal. And I think members of Congress have every right to be angry that that the president showed basically no respect at all for Congress's views on this subject before he took the crucial action of removing those sanctions. What a lot of people don't understand, it's clear from the debates on television and radio that this is not a point that people appreciate. If the president had not gone to the UN to remove those sanctions, the situation we would be in would be this. Those sanctions said that the Iranians have to actually roll back their nuclear program. Those sanctions said that there were severe economic penalties imposed on Iran unless Iran, for example, completely stopped enrichment of uranium. And it said that those sanctions cannot be removed unless the UN weapons inspectors certified that the Iranians had done a long list of things, including things like completely stop their uranium enrichment. Now, had this deal not been made, those sanctions would have remained in place. And even if the Chinese and the Russians regretted that they supported the sanctions to begin with, there was nothing they could have done about them, because in order to remove them, you'd have to pass a new resolution that the United States would have to vote for. We had a veto. And so we could have kept those sanctions in place indefinitely. And so when the president says there was no alternative to this deal, the alternative to this deal would have been simply to leave those UN sanctions, which were quite tough. Now, it's important to understand they were not tough enough to actually force the Iranians to give up their weapons program. That's been clear. But they were tough enough to do really severe economic harm to Iran. And that at least limited the Iranian government's ability to do harm.
Which brings us back to your earlier point that there was a coercive diplomatic option still on the table until the president removed it through this action meant clearly to circumvent and, I think, sabotage whatever congressional oversight there might have been. Doug, we will be fighting them on the beaches and fighting them in the streets on this one, I think, in the Congress and elsewhere. And we look forward to doing so with your insights and great leadership. Thank you for all of your service to our country. It is a distinct privilege to have you as a colleague and friend, and I'm very grateful to you for taking the time to discuss all of these issues with us, and I hope you'll come back to us again very soon to do more of it, especially as this, possibly tragic circumstance plays out. I hope the rest of you will come back for more tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.